Hey folks, my name is Dr. Amy Perlman. I'm a board-certified urologist with expertise in sexual, hormonal, and genitourinary health, and welcome to today's episode of Pearls and Perspectives. I have Heather Floria with us today. Heather, say hello to the crew.
Hello, everybody.
So Heather, you and I recently connected, and we were just kind of catching up before we started this recording, and you were telling me a little bit about your busy week over the last week in DC. Tell us more. What happened in DC?
Yeah, so interestingly enough, I was in New York City in meetings, and I got this invite last week at the last second to be in DC for the big, of course, they're not saying what originally, except for we all kind of knew, women's health announcement. And I was honored to be one of the, 30, 40 women that were in that room, being able to hear this amazing announcement that they're removing the black box from HRT, which has been needed for 6 years since the 2019 study was done that debunked the Women's Health Initiative from 2002 that led to this warning being put on. And this is going to be a game changer for both clinicians and for women. We don't have to. They don't have to feel as fearful about prescribing, HRT to their patients. And I think this is going to make a world of difference. And as a menopausal woman myself, HRT is a lifesaver, a game changer. When you don't feel like yourself, you feel like you've lost, you're all over the place. We all know these symptoms, and we've heard them time and time again. And I think that the ability for women to be able to have HRT, makes us continue to feel normal. Whereas, with menopausal symptoms, we are definitely down a different path and do not feel like ourselves. We struggle to stay awake. We struggle to function. This is often in times where the age in which jobs come into jeopardy, marriages come into jeopardy. So many things can come into jeopardy at this point. And that's why I think this is going to be an amazing game changer for women.
I love that. And the focus of today's discussion is actually going to be on non-hormonal therapies for urinary and bladder and pelvic pain symptoms in women. So I guess what's your take on that? Because you're the CEO of Desert Harvest and your products are non-hormonal. So how does that play and how do you reconcile that with now you're saying like hormonal therapy for women is super important?
So I kind of always balance that. I am very much of the mind of giving women what they need. And for me, yes, I am a natural company that we started with natural foundations, natural ideas of how we could approach healthcare for women. But at the same time, we need a balance between, traditional medicine and natural medicine in my mind. Because, for instance, when we talk about interstitial cystitis, that we've been able to, Dr. Ackerman at UCLA, she was able to subtype into three distinct categories of phenotyping, in which we were able to find myofascial pain, 88% resolved with pelvic floor physical therapy. You have this neuralgia group, but then you have this bladder specific group. So now, if we can subtype them out, and give them the treatments that they need exclusive to them. For instance, interstitial cystitis, I think when you get to those bladder-centric patients, I think, for instance, you've got a mix there. You've got a mix of women who have what has not been clinically termed an autoimmune condition now at this point, but we know that if you take the bladder away, you put in a neobladder, other things like that, that it begins to attack maybe a transplanted bladder or a neobladder. And so as a result, we know there's a theory that's always been floated that interstitial cystitis is an autoimmune disorder. But then we have this whole subset that I think that are hormonally related, that these are menopausal changes because they're not getting HRT. The epithelial cell layer, the urothelial cell layer of their bladder is beginning to degrade. And over time, they develop interstitial cystitis. So if we could head that off at least for a subsection of interstitial cystitis patients, when we have 8 to 12 million men and women in the United States that suffer from interstitial cystitis, estimated by the Interstitial Cystitis Association, I think that we have done a disservice to a portion of those patients, because if they were on HRT, Now, mind you, we haven't fully studied this. We really need to look further into this, but this is all theoretical at this point. But the theory would be, we know that the urothelial cell layer of the bladder breaks down in menopause. We know that we have a higher incidence of menopausal patients over the age of 50, from 40 on, 45 on up. And so if that patient population, if we could tackle that with HRT, and then, the SSAV that Desert Harvest is undergoing FDA clinical trials for right now, for drug trials, that could be, or other options could be, a piece that focuses on maybe what may be theoretically an autoimmune component of interstitial cystitis. And we've got this to tackle this and this to tackle this. So this is where I always think combination.
Yeah. Oh, I love that message because it's not two different types of therapies going against each other. It's understanding that in certain populations, this is going to work, and others, this is going to work. But probably most of the time, it's like this comp it's a combination in terms of therapy. So let's take a few steps back here, Heather. Heather, who are you and what do you do?
So my name is Heather Florio. I am the CEO of Desert Harvest. We are a company that has been in business, family-owned company that's been in business since 1993, providing pelvic and health, sexual health solutions to patients all over the world. We focus, obviously, our first keystone product was the SSAV, which was predominantly 75% women have interstitial cystitis, only about
And really quick,
25% men.
SSAV stands for super strength aloe vera.
Yes, it does. It does. But this isn't the aloe vera that you find in the health food store. So we can go into that a little bit. But this is a very unique, and that's kind of why we call it SSAV, to, delineate consumer confusion and think that you can safely go take any other product out that's in a health food store and get the exact same results. And so it is very important for us. We developed this formulation, with scientific research from the beginning. It was very important that we would look at how this affected patients, what would be the benefits, how to make it safe for long-term use and at high doses. And then over time, because our population was 75% women, we just began developing products. Pelvic health started to become a field really in the 90s as we were growing. And so we grew with it. We've been at every meeting that you could think of since the inception of the International Pelvic Pain Society, and in the early 2000s. And so it's been a goal for ours to meet unmet needs of women's health, especially, although we do have a percentage of men, we do predominantly focus on women's health.
So how did your family get in, like how did aloe vera even come up as a potential therapeutic? And how did this idea of treating people with pelvic pain and pelvic issues come about? Because as you mentioned, when your family started this company, it wasn't really as much of a thing as it is now in terms of people being aware of the pelvic floor and how important that is.
Oh, yes. For many patients, in the early 90s, we couldn't even get it recognized as a condition in many cases. And it was a disease in women's heads at that point, in most cases. And so we have really, my aunt actually had interstitial cystitis. She was diagnosed in 1992. We started looking for avenues of everything. She was at the Mayo Clinic. We were looking at every possible option that was out there because there was no options. And she was very obviously suffering, voiding, constantly through the night, anywhere from 50 to 80 times a day. And yeah, it was bad. She pretty much lived on the toilet. And she was staying with us. It was my mom's sister, and we were desperately trying to find something. So we went to her, my mother and my aunt went to some random natural products conference, just to see what was out there, what was new in research, things like that. And they happened to come across some random aloe vera. And my aunt is, she loves to experiment. So she took the whole bottle and she slept through the entire night. And which had been unheard of for years. And so we immediately went, wait, there's something here. But aloe vera naturally has negative compounds in it, anthraquinones. These are latex chemicals that long-term are carcinogenic to the colon. So what you see in the health food stores, you'll see words like digestive aids, things like that. These are not meant to be for long-term use and in high doses, which an interstitial cystitis patient needs. This is meant for literally short-term bursts, maybe for a week, to help with digestive discomfort. It acts as a natural laxative, irritating that colon and acting more as a spasmodic. And so as a result, it can also lead to liver damage, kidney damage. There's a variety of things that can happen as a result of anthraquinones. And we are the only ones that have a unique patented process that can filter all of those out while maintaining the high nutrient content. Anybody could filter out anthraquinones utilizing charcoal, but the thing is that you also lose all of the nutrients. And so this was very important early on when we were looking at the chemistry, trying to determine how we could make this safe for long-term use and high doses. And we still use that same formulation today, 20, 30, almost 33 years later.
Wow. Has it evolved over the 30 years?
No. Actually, we have been using the same formulation. We have never changed anything in our process, anything like that. We have the only thing that occasionally changes and gets more revolutionary is the science regarding the capsules, and how we utilize a vegan capsule, and that way it's safe for everybody to use. It's free of all common allergens. And so this was very important to us in the evolution of what type of capsules we used. We're very much of the idea that not to put something in the product that your body doesn't need. As we all know, supplements are packed full of additional ingredients, fillers. We don't know what's actually truthfully in them. For instance, this is not supplement related, but this is aloe vera related. In 2016, Bloomberg did a study. They went to Walmart, CVS, and Walgreens, and they pulled all of the aloe vera gelées off of the shelf, and they tested all of them. And if you do a simple test, maltodextrin can mimic aloe vera on HPLC testing. But interestingly enough, they tested all of these with much more high-powered, expensive testing and found out that none of them actually contained aloe vera, and every single one of them were full of maltodextrin.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, I
So
tell it's interesting because in the medical field, you know, as a physician, we're never really taught how to educate our patients on supplements. And so it becomes a very polarizing discussion where I think a lot of us say, don't take any supplements because they're unregulated. And the reality is, that's not all true. There are good supplements. And I think one of our most important roles as healthcare providers is to figure out which ones those are and which ones could be beneficial. So our patients aren't taking handfuls of supplements at a time, but like everyone plays a role. And if it doesn't work, then that person should probably stop it. But I always tell my patients, like, don't get that crap from the typical convenience store. These are the companies I recommend. They do third-party testing. I know the people that run the companies. I know they're legit people and I trust this product, but I don't think a lot of people are going into the weeds in terms of the science behind the innovation.
No, they're not. Marketing is a great thing, and there are a lot of people marketing to doctors, and as a result, it leaves, kind of a wide open spectrum and an issue with safety and not feeling comfortable for doctors to recommend supplements as a result of that. So as you said, third party testing is critical. Not every company is required to do it, but every company is required to get certified for their good manufacturing practices by the FDA. If not, they receive letters, all different kinds of things like this. It's all on the internet now. You can literally Google a company the word FDA, and you can see what comes up. And you can do this for any company to see if they're getting letters, but you can also ask a company, are you certified for your good manufacturing practices? Are you third-party tested? Could you provide me with a certificate of analysis showing that data? There is no reason why you can't request any of that information. And if they can't provide it, that's an immediate red flag for you.
So you mentioned a term natural in your discussion of the product. What does natural mean?
I mean, here's the thing. As someone who manufactures supplements, natural is that plant that you see out in the yard, that aloe vera plant. And the minute you cut that leaf off and you begin to utilize it or process it or change it, is it really natural at that point? So natural is just a really good marketing word. We use the words natural origin because for us, yes, our ingredients are coming from nature. There are many things that you see that are coming from different like sugar molecules. If you see something that says like potassium sorbate on it, like it evolves from sugar molecules. So where are we going with this? So there are a lot of things that are made from coconut but look like words that you can't pronounce. And that's a great thing that both doctors and patients have the ability to do is there are things like the environmental working group. You can go there and you can put in magnesium stearate. And you can determine whether or not they're telling you the toxicity of something. And they have a scale that rates the toxicity of something, of whether it's one low, three, four, high, super high. And so that's the great thing is you have the ability now as consumers and clinicians to be able to go and say, what is magnesium stearate? It's, why are they utilizing this in the product? And they're utilizing it for the machines, but there are natural alternatives. They can even use things like olive oil, a variety of different things because they need lubricants for the machines. They don't have to use magnesium stearate. They use magnesium stearate because it's cheap.
Wow, interesting. So it's interesting too because I feel like there are new products that companies put out all the time that are like slight variations, or maybe the marketing on the packaging is slightly different. But I love that your company is using the same product that it used 30 years ago. When it works, right? I love it.
Exactly. We have this, we're in this society now where, someone will be like, oh, well, I have aloe vera in it and I've added quercetin and I've added this and I've added this ingredient and now I have a whole new product and it's the best thing ever. But here's the thing, and this is where like we sell a multivitamin product, but because people like ease and convenience and we wanted to provide a low acid option. But I also subscribe to the belief that don't take something you don't need. And so that's why a lot of our products are very much single element products, because we're not looking to combine and put some pretty marketing terms on it and be like, check out this new revolutionary ingredient. Instead, I'm like, do you really need that magnesium right now? Do you need extra calcium? Why are you taking it? Because society thinks you should, because you think it's going to be good for your bone density. Have you tested your bone density? Do you actually need this? This is very important to me to be able to not have people take things that they don't need.
I love that. Oftentimes, less is more, right?
Yes, exactly. That's exactly it. And I think we need to get back to that because there have been so many products flooding the market lately that just combine a bunch of product ingredients together and say, oh, these five ingredients are amazing for menopause. You should take this product because it's gonna change your life. And because there might have been a brief study that might have denoted at the potential possibility that maca maca could help your hot flashes or something like that.
So let's delve into why this matters, right, for the people watching. And you already alluded to the fact that there are, several million people suffering with interstitial cystitis, in the country, men and women. And honestly, I see and chronic UTIs and pelvic pain in men and women are like the bane of the existence for every urologist and primary care provider, and like so many of us as healthcare providers. So I guess my question is, like, how does someone tease out if your products could be helpful for their patients? And how do we tease out, is this like a chronic UTI scenario? Is this IC? How are we supposed to treat them?
And that becomes a difficult thing. Many of the interstitial cystitis patients, I'll hear stories of taking 30 years or more to get diagnosed. Because it takes so long for us to determine whether or not we utilize diagnosis of exclusion here in the United States. The rest of the world uses diagnosis via cystoscopy for interstitial cystitis. It's an uncomfortable, painful procedure for the patient, and I understand why we probably dialed back a little bit on it. But at the same time, I also think that we're doing a disservice in that sense because, they in socialized medicine, it was interesting. I was at an interstitial cystitis meeting before AUA this year in at Wake Forest in North Carolina, and one of the doctors was talking like, he goes as far, and this is the difference between socialized medicine and not, like, we have the limits of what insurance will allow us to do, everything. And he's all like, oh, he's like, I just did an exploratory laparoscopy where, I wanted to look at, I'm going to exclude endometriosis embedded in the backside of the bladder. I'm going to exclude this, this, and this. I'm going to do all of these things before I determine that a patient has interstitial cystitis. And for us, what we do is we have years of pelvic pain being talked about, constant frequency, UTIs, sometimes with the recurrent UTIs, we get this antibiotic overusage and we're constantly prescribing, prescribing, prescribing. And I don't know if that leads to the long-term detriment of interstitial cystitis or if they already had it and we were just pumping them full of antibiotics that they didn't need. And it's really a journey for an interstitial cystitis patient. And in determining what makes the best sense, we have D-mannose out on the market that can be used as a preventative, as a supplement, but it only binds in clinical research to E. coli bacteria. So D-mannose is that mannose is actually one of the molecules naturally in aloe vera. So that's why we have never sold a D-mannose product because there's no need if you're taking the SSAV. There's absolutely no need at that point. It's just extra money, extra marketing, extra, at that point if you're on the SSAV. But then we did just recently create, for instance, Heather's UTI defense. So we're finishing up clinical research at Oxford University right now. And we wanted to understand if there were other compounds that could bind to more than just E. coli bacteria. And so that's where we came up with the Heather's UTI defense, because in clinical research, we're showing three, potentially five bacterias that Heather's UTI defense can bind to. And so we've just now tripled the potential protection because we now know that it definitely binds to three bacterias. And so we're really excited. We actually are just releasing that product this month, and we hope to be releasing the research early next year because this could be a game changer for those that experience recurrent UTIs that we have an unknown etiology and maybe have nothing to do with interstitial cystitis. And so we're really excited to bring that product out. So there are options. And we're also looking, we've tried with interstitial cystitis to see if we could find urine biomarkers that then we could diagnose via urinalysis. And every time we've come up short. And I think that a lot of that has to do with the patient population we're studying. I don't think we truly have a lot of interstitial cystitis patients. I think that we have a variety of potentially other comorbidities that are affecting the pelvic region and affecting the bladder, but not necessarily the bladder as the root cause. But if we were actually diagnosing via cystoscopy and looking at the bladder wall and that we saw true bladder wall impact, we saw, inflammation, we're seeing ulcerative, Hunter's ulcers, things like that within the bladder wall, then we would know that's an interstitial cystitis patient right there. But we were having a problem, and I saw this evolve through the 90s where they were doing all these cystoscopies. I think we stopped them in the early 2000s as a regular form of diagnosis for interstitial cystitis. And what we were seeing was back then is they were doing all these cystoscopies and they were coming up short because they'd be like, well, there's nothing, your bladder looks beautiful. And they're like, but I'm in horrible pain and I'm voiding constantly. Like, well, what is going on? And I think that the problem was is we had all of these other comorbidities involved that we've never been able to truly phenotype out and subtype into other areas. And I think that that does a disservice to interstitial cystitis research. And I think that's why we've really never gotten very far with interstitial cystitis research because of those barriers of the patient population for clinical research.
And so you mentioned research, and you're funding a lot of this research, and yet so much of the products that are part of like nutraceuticals and available over the counter really have no research to support their use, or a company might come out with a product to, let's say, increase blood flow, something like ashwagandha or like a nitric oxide supplement. And that company's not actually doing the research, but they're kind of like going on the coattails of another company that did research on their product. And what I tell patients is just because one ashwagandha product may show benefit doesn't mean the one that you actually buy has the same ingredients and has the same benefit. So what does it take as someone who's in this nutraceutical business to like self-fund clinical research? How difficult or easy is it to do?
We are a small family company. There are some amazing clinicians out there that believe in what we are trying to do and really help us through. Like right now, we're doing our FDA drug trials at Wake Forest University for the SSAV. Dr. Robert Evans has been invaluable in making that possible and moving that forward. And we value his expertise and his partnership, and we're sad that he's retiring out, but at the same time, we have the ability to be able to do this. When we want to invest in a product, I'm not going to bring it to market unless I have something behind it, even if it's just case studies. And I've done it, with one of our topicals. For instance, we have Relievium, which has 4% lidocaine in it, and it's a patented blend of plant botanicals that we developed. It's an over-the-counter drug that we developed for radiation dermatitis. But we wanted to make sure it could go everywhere. And could be used for vaginal cancers, anal cancers, that it could be, but we wanted to understand how it worked before we brought it to market. And actually, our chemist's daughter had lymphoma, and she started taking it to her cancer groups, and we started distributing it out and understanding because she had started using it at first, and at one point she couldn't even put a shirt on. And so then we got to the point where we were able to find out that the whole group was like, where are you selling this? Where can I get this? And then the really interesting part from a pelvic pain perspective is we naturally already had, patients who have vulvodynia, lichen sclerosus, lichen planus, and we didn't even think about this. And they all started using it, like for external urethral pain, all different kinds of things. But again, we haven't studied that, but women just started utilizing it for that purpose. And now it's one of the biggest uses. But then we have like our SSAV capsules or the Heather's UTI Defense, and a variety of others that we've brought to market with significant amounts of research. With Desert Harvest, I think we did with the SSAV, we did our first clinical study in 1995, double-blind, placebo-controlled. The limits for us are is that our studies are going to be smaller. One, because cost. We are still a small family company. We are not some large pharmaceutical company. But it is very important for us to be able to understand. So, like for instance, in this particular study, we're actually looking in li at live urothelial cells, and we're watching how the SSAV interacts with the urothelial cell layer of the bladder, because we know that SSAV, that ours is packed full of glycosaminoglycans, and that is coating the bladder. We know that Elmeron, which everybody is very hesitant now to kind of prescribe, a lot of urologists and things like that. We know that they do this synthetically, and we all know the problems that that has led to. So for us, we've known that it's coating the bladder and it's acting as a protective barrier as things pass through. We know that within 72 hours, that it's all going to be out of your bladder if you stop taking the product. We know the life cycle there. And then we also know that it's having high anti-inflammatory and analgesic action within the bladder. But we don't know anything beyond that. We know that there's over 200 nutrients actively or naturally in the aloe vera plant. 75 of them are actually active nutrients. And so we want to understand exactly how it's interacting with the urothelial cell. So this study is the first of its kind where we're able to go a step further because of their regenerative medicine department at Wake Forest. We're able to watch in live time it interacting with the urothelial cell layer of the bladder. They're able to harvest urothelial cells, and then we can watch how the SSAV is interacting with those cells, and the mechanism of action that's happening even under the urothelial cell layer of the bladder, because we know that many times people will be like, "Oh, I'm in remission." And you're like, there's no such thing as being cured, or patients love to throw those words around, and then unfortunately that might last sometimes for years, and then they have a flare, and we even have breakthrough flares while they're on the SSAV. And those are usually due to foods of some sort, high amounts of stress, we've correlated that to, but we really don't understand this. And I think it's very important for us as a supplement company to understand our products, all the way from the cellular level to all the way to pure just ingestion, and to understand exactly how they are functioning within the human body and the benefit they provide or don't provide. We've dropped many of products that were over the years that we've been like, I don't think this is needed anymore. This product replaces this product, so on and so forth. For instance, our new lactoferrin, which we can talk about a little bit, is one that there are a couple of products I might be phasing out as a result of what lactoferrin can do for the body. And so as we advance in the science and what we're able to create and what we're able to do, I want to bring those products to market that have the research, the safety, the efficacy behind them.
Well, I definitely applaud you for putting in the work, the time, the money, the resources to doing those studies, because I know that's really challenging to do. You said the first study you did was a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial. Those are super challenging, right? After every retrospective study, you look at the conclusions and it says, we need randomized placebo-controlled trials in the future to actually answer this question. And so you wonder, why isn't someone doing it? And then you get involved in a study like that and you realize it is really challenging and time-consuming and expensive to do. So I definitely
It
applaud
is.
you for those efforts. So you made some reference to some patient populations that some of your topical therapies might help. So in this space of like breast cancer therapy, hormone treatment, a lot of people get nervous about using topical vaginal therapy in women who have a history of breast cancer or are being treated for breast cancer. Talk to me, would any of your products help that population? Because that population seems to be a very difficult population of women to treat.
Yes, when we're talking menopausal symptoms in breast cancer patients, there the lactoferrin I just mentioned shows potential benefit as an alternative to HRT for breast cancer-related patients. Now, interestingly enough, there are two where there's research, there's conflicting research. So there are a couple of breast cancers that even then can't have the lactoferrin. But there are most breast cancers, even estrogen dominant breast cancers, that can have the lactoferrin and actually can benefit from it in supporting their menopausal symptoms if they are not able to take HRT. And so we just introduced last, oh gosh, the end of September, I think it was, the first human bioidentical lactoferrin. It's called Affera. It's made by a company, Helena, that we partnered with. We wanted to bring something to market that could make a difference. You know, I could have brought out, 10 different supplements and said they worked for menopause just to make money off of patients. But because of who we are, we have not done that. We've never brought out a menopause supplement because I believe that the evidence out there is lacking on any of the supplemental ingredients that potentially show minor benefit, and we haven't looked enough at the safety. So for me, I have never brought out a menopause product until now, and that is the human bioidentical lactoferrin. And we brought this out with the understanding that so right now there have been, like you talked about, retrospective studies that have looked at the benefits of lactoferrin, but they've always looked at bovine. And bovine does not function the same way in the human body that actual human bioidentical lactoferrin will function. So if you think about it, this is in the colostrum that babies get in their first few months of life. It's actually in our vagina. Lactoferrin is naturally in our vaginal microbiomes. It's in our tears, our saliva, and it can be the building blocks in those first few months of life of cellular growth and development. And so imagine if you take that as an adult. And so that is why it was very important for us to find something that could f mimic and function the exact way, same way in the human body. So there's Helena has done, I think they're up to 16 or 18 studies that they've done now. And they are hard looking at this for a variety of different indications, beyond even what we're talking about. We're with menopause, the biggest thing is going to be the iron optimization. So this is binding and transporting. This is going to block for those that might have like hemochromatosis. This is going to block iron buildup, but optimize iron production. And then as a result, optimize estrogen production. It's going to optimize immune function. And so that is the great thing. And you can definitely, we have a lot of these studies on our website and information and resources regarding the lactoferrin. But this is an alternative for those breast cancer patients that cannot take HRT or they're, like I said, though, definitely, and I, you know, of course, I'm sitting here blanking, but there are two types of breast cancer, but they're not the estrogen dominant ones in which lactoferrin was counterindicated. And that was a result of the research and looking. But interestingly enough, some of the research even supported the potential that, of course, would need to be studied more, the potential of even anti-cancer activity. Because of that immune system boost potential, and but also blocking the negatives, the negative, you know, boosting cytokines, but blocking negative pathways. The what's the killer cells, is blocking those, and so there is a lot of potential even for gut function. So even menopausal women that are experiencing gut issues, this is going to optimize lactobacillus, both in the gut and in the vagina. And so as a result, you're We're actually even looking at potentially creating an insertable that we would be able, suppository that we could get directly to the vaginal microbiome versus ingesting it. But the current studies are all based on ingestion. And so they even showed microbiome, vaginal microbiome benefits just from ingesting as well. But optimizing gut health, optimizing immune system function. When you talk about collagen, and we take a collagen supplement, this goes back into supplementation. Is it good? Is it not? We use a particular type of collagen in our collagen supplements that is directed directly at the joints. But at the same time, there are other strains. There are multiple different, 10 different strains, I think, of collagen that are currently on the market that some of them can actually lead to tissue fibrosis because you're getting an overabundance of collagen to the tissues. And so instead of putting collagen, this is one of those products I'm debating whether I'm going to keep, because the lactoferrin actually optimizes the collagen tissue you already has and already helps you synthesize it. So, when you're even talking joints, hair, nails, skin, everything else like that, it's going to be an additional benefit because it's synthesizing collagen naturally versus, supplementing collagen, hoping it gets to the right place and that you're taking the right strain.
So you mentioned a term in reference to the lactoferrin product, and you said bioidentical. Can you, because oftentimes I think of that in the hormone space as also being a marketing term, just like natural. What does bioidentical mean to you?
It means that we have synthesized that Helena has synthesized it in the lab. And mind you, I was just in their labs like 2 weeks ago. Amazing. They literally go all the way. This is how we follow it. We're trying to synthesize via yeast production and other things like that. It goes through these various levels until we're only taking out those lactoferrin cells and nothing else. So it's literally cultured at the beginning so that at the end we actually get human lactoferrin cells. So that's why it's bioidentical because we're not extracting it from human, because that's why bovine's been on the market. We can't milk a woman, and we never would. And so, the cows, that's what we've been relying on this entire time. And there's actually an entire market where women actually sell breast milk on the black market for bodybuilders and other things like that, because they will pay bank for it. But that what they're trying to get out of that is the lactoferrin that's in that breast milk. And so by synthesizing it within a lab, that's where the term bioidentical comes, because we're not extracting it from a human, but we're synthesizing it from initial cells that we are then extracting the good lactoferrin cells from, the strongest ones.
Gotcha. So let me ask you this, because your website has a lot of different supplements on the shop page. And I want to, even though a focus of our discussion was treating patients who have interstitial cystitis and pelvic pain, I want you to go through like the top supplements that you really believe could be helpful. And in which patient population might they be helpful for? Because we touch on patients going through menopause and women with breast cancer, and so I don't want people to think that you have to have IC to maybe benefit from one of these supplements, but maybe you do. So if you could tease that out a little bit, like which supplements might be beneficial for which people? And do you have to have a problem to benefit from any of these supplements?
Yeah, no, definitely. So I'll just kind of run through the gambit here. We talked about the multivitamin. I made that because I wanted to make a low acid version. So this was very important. A lot of our
Why does a
supplements.
low acid version matter? Because I've never heard that before related to multivitamins.
Okay, so a lot of the times, especially for interstitial cystitis patients or anybody where something could be acidity, could be a bladder irritant, things like vitamin C. Could be a bladder irritant. B6 is a bladder irritant. There are a variety of different compounds where we have to look at if our calcium citrate would be, magnesium citrate. We have all these different supplement ingredients that could become a bladder irritant. So obviously our population would be very sensitive to that. And so we are looking at what kind of ingredients make sense for our population. And, even though I love single-use ingredients, we also love the ease of just waking up and feeling like we're getting our nutrition. And we were begged, it actually took us 25 years to bring out a multivitamin because I finally like broke down because there were so many requests. And so we made our multivitamin low acid. It does not have B6. The other thing we recently removed is B3. And the reason why we did that is because recent research shows that the overabundance of niacin being fortified in all of our foods and then supplementing on top of that was leading to cardiovascular disease. And so B3 is one of those ingredients that I'd say do without if you can, because unless you have some reason, because it's fortified in all of our foods and all of our grocery stores on purpose. And so same with our B complex. So we have a B complex. So the B complex is multi-use. So obviously the first and greatest thing that everybody goes to it for is energy. So it's ours is again without the B6, without the B3. Also in our multivitamin and our B complex, we utilize the methylated forms of the B9 and the B12. And actually now the B2, we just were able to methylate B2. Because what that means is the methylated versions process easier with your body. Folic acid, things like that, they can take a little bit longer for your body to have to break down. And so as a result, we use like L-methylfolate instead of folic acid, because it's easier for your body to digest and process in the methylated form. But the other benefit can be for those that have like gene mutations, the what is it, the MFTHR gene mutation, variety of things like that. There are conditions in which they cannot have any other versions of those because their body can't break them down, but the methylated versions. And so there are a variety of benefits in taking, but the B complex also is going to help with metabolic function as well. It's one of the best things ever is it, when you're looking at taking is having the inositol, other things like that in there that are really going to help with metabolism, nervous system, pancreatic health, with a B complex. So there are a myriad of benefits to taking a B vitamin, and ours is made specifically and formulated for a variety of different conditions. And then same with our probiotic. So our probiotic was developed when we were looking, and again, if the lactoferrin proves true, as it has in research, this may or may not be one that sticks around if we can optimize gut function without having to take pre or probiotics. That might be a benefit. But right now, we chose the Bifidobacterium infantis strain. And this is the only strain that has been proven in clinical research to not inflame autoimmune conditions. And so, if we go with the theory that interstitial cystitis may be an autoimmune condition, this is only an added benefit. And so most people don't realize that probiotics, prebiotics, a lot of them can actually inflame and cause an inflammatory response within the body. And when you're already suffering from, a cytokine type storm can happen occasionally. And so that is why we chose the probiotic this way. And then we have a buffered vitamin C. And so what we do with that is we're buffering out utilizing calcium to buffer out the acidity of the vitamin C for those that want that additional immune support. But again, the lactoferrin could potentially also take care of that as well. And then the calcium and vitamin D3. So we utilize this and our calcium glycerol phosphate kind of interchangeably. We're not looking to supplement for a calcium deficiency. So we utilize the calcium carbonate form with vitamin D3 and our calcium and vitamin D3. It's the most basic elemental form of calcium. It is also the cheapest, but at the same time, it is also the best for reducing acidity, that the negative acidity within the gut with foods, with related to acidic foods. So this is great for people that have interstitial cystitis or other conditions where acidic foods and drinks and things like that might interfere. Calcium glycerol phosphate is the same, it can do the same thing, but this is one you more take right before you eat food, the calcium glycerol phosphate. And this is going to help with the digestion. Both of them interchangeably will help with digestion. And if you think of the calcium carbonate, that's like your Tums, but with vitamin D3 added as a buffer, because sometimes that can be a little harsh and things like that. And then in addition, we have our magnesium. So because people supplement these calciums pretty regularly, things like that, we always need equal parts magnesium to equal parts calcium in the body, or you're going to get constipated. There's just no question about it. And so we always have utilized the magnesium oxide form. Again, a more basic form of magnesium, but the best form at redirecting water to the bowel. And so that is why we utilize the magnesium oxide form. If you're looking to supplement magnesium, then you want to look at other forms like glycinate, things like that. Even same with the calciums. If you're looking to supplement, you want to look at alternative, more bioactive forms if you have a deficiency. These are not meant for deficiencies. And then the collagen that I had mentioned, which is the closest, that you're going to get. We use the type 1 and type 3, which is more optimized for women and is looking at directing specifically at that tissue growth. And then when we talk about some of our others, we have like the quercetin. So the quercetin is going to be your ultimate, like, so this is a flavonoid, and it's going to be really good for that allergic bladder. And quercetin is going to calm that histamine response naturally in the body. It is one of those ones where you have to follow the dosage specifically, because you can overdose on quercetin. It can cause kidney damage. Ours is sourced from the Sephora japonica plant. We used to, back in the day, only be able to harvest it once a year. So for our first like 15 years of desert harvest, we had to guesstimate how much we needed for an entire year for harvest time. And then that's all we'd get. And it was like July, August, and we'd harvest, and then we'd have to guess the rest of the time. And so now we've developed a preservation method, and we can make it more sustainable. That one kind of flies off the shelf. And that's a good tool with the SSAV, actually. So if the SSAV related to interstitial cystitis doesn't benefit enough from, support enough from interstitial cystitis, that's where we look at quercetin, because many people just have that mast cell activation component that is related. And obviously, when they get flares during high allergy times, spring and fall, they're usually worse from spring to fall. And then by adding that quercetin on seems to make a difference for their bladder flares. And
How does
so,
someone know if they have an allergic bladder?
some people will just term it. So, with regards to the allergic bladder, it's an immune response. And so we're looking at high histamine levels. In allergy testing, we can definitely look at what they're allergic to, but we and that can be things that are going to pass. But when we're talking about environmental allergies that impact the bladder, in most cases, what I think is being given right now is hydroxyzine, and it's more just trial and error than anything else that they utilize, because it's not like we can go, skin test the bladder and determine what their histamines, what they're responding to. We can look at histamine levels, definitely, but we can't, look beyond that per se. And so as a result, it's more, consultation, looking at, do they have other allergens? Have they been allergy tested? Are they exposed to, when exposed to environmental allergens, which seems to be most of the cases, because most of them seem to flare with the seasons. So it doesn't seem to be as like food related as environmental related. And so I think a direct correlation could potentially be, and again, never been studied, but if we looked at the correlation between seasonal allergies and the bladder, we might find naturally that, hey, you need this, you need hydroxyzine, you need quercetin, that kind of thing.
So let me ask you this, because you mentioned there's a possibility of taking too much of the quercetin. So would this be something that someone takes as needed when they have a flare, or would this be something someone takes on a regular basis?
So a lot of these people take it on a regular basis to keep the histamine response. It's just that you follow that dosage. You follow that dosage protocol. Don't take any more because you feel your allergies flaring or something like that. That doesn't mean take more. And it's just one of those cautionary tales to say, this is a product that you could really easily overdose on. Don't take more than what's recommended on the bottle.
And then if you could touch on the SSAV and the lactoferrin, like who are the patients who would really benefit from those, other than, let's say, patients who have interstitial cystitis?
So we have, so with the SSAV, the best, we do have men that take it for non-bacterial prostatitis as well. In our initial study, we utilized it. We did have non-bacterial prostatitis patients included. There is benefit beyond interstitial cystitis. But in our double-blind placebo-controlled studies, we have an 87.5% response rate of some or complete relief of all symptoms with just taking our capsules. And that has been followed up since then. And we did a questionnaire with the Interstitial Cystitis Association, and we got a 92% re response rate. And so this is, we're talking frequency, burning, pain. We're talking nocturia, the entire complexity of interstitial cystitis. We're talking about all those symptom markers, and that we're looking at through questionnaires, through avoiding diaries, everything else throughout our journeys with these patients in clinical trials.
Patients who don't really have predominant urinary symptoms, but they have, let's say, pain with intercourse, maybe some urgency, maybe some frequency, but not like the typical IC patient, or maybe a gentleman who has perineal pain or tip of penis pain or right testicular pain, but not really any associated urinary symptoms. Could this help in those patient populations? And even if you don't have clinical studies, do you feel like you've had feedback in that patient population?
We have had some positive feedback. We had one that he was a male patient who was self-cathing. I was a cop on duty 12 times a day. And he received significant benefit, and I don't know his initial diagnosis, but it was not interstitial cystitis. So we have seen some benefits, but we have not studied. Interestingly enough, the one that we should study is more gastrointestinal, that we have had huge feedback on, which is ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. And I think that if we were going to go anywhere beyond in research, those might be the additional avenues that we would pursue. There, it beyond interstitial cystitis and non-bacterial prostatitis, we have seen selective benefit reported over the years. Whether that's placebo effect or actual true benefit, we don't know. But we definitely have had some people report different markers. But the predominant evidence has been with interstitial cystitis and
So let me
non-bacterial
ask you this. What
prostatitis.
if someone legitimately has a urinary tract infection, whether they're a man or a woman? Would either the lactoferrin or the SSAV be used as like a supportive measure while they're like being treated for their UTI to help reduce some of the symptoms?
I would say the lactoferrin, just because we've already shown the benefits that it can have in the vaginal microbiome, and we know that it's having a benefit to the bladder and to the immune system, and that it can also flush out bacteria as well, in the research that's been done. So I think that if I was going to say anything, it would definitely be the lactoferrin. The SSAV will have a direct impact on the bladder. If you have any type of bladder wall impact, you're looking at high inflammatory markers, and things like that. But when you start to look at bacteria, again, we're only talking D-mannose there, and we're only talking E. coli bacteria, whereas the lactoferrin isn't subjective in the bacteria that it seems to bind to. And has more positive benefits when it comes subjective to bacteria.
So let's say someone is preparing for, let's say, a procedure on their prostate for an enlarged prostate, right? And they know they're going in for the procedure, and then they're going to have a catheter afterwards, and they're going to be healing from that. And it's very common to have some urgency, frequency, maybe some blood in the urine during that recovery. Would any of your supplements, could they potentially be helpful in that sort of like preparative point and recovery point?
The SSAV. So there are immune support properties as well, but the biggest thing that would be a benefit would be the high anti-inflammatory and analgesic nature of helping to calm that inflammation of the prostate, especially if they're getting ready for a prostate removal surgery or anything else like that. We have seen many people take it before surgeries and things like that. Now, again, counterintuitive to the evidence if you Google aloe vera, just FYI. And that is because you will see a lot of evidence that you should stop it before surgery, other things like that, because of the anthraquinones. They can act as a blood thinner and thin the blood as well. But again, that's related to a component that's not in the Desert Harvest SSAV. And we've had many people take it before, after, during surgery. But again, we haven't, studied that to be able to support, but we know the ingredient that's causing it, and we know that ingredient's not in our SSAV.
So could these products replace Peridium?
As an anesthetic.
Because we're limited in terms of how much Peridium can take, as they're, helping to manage some of the bladder pain symptoms related to a procedure, related to a catheter, related to a urinary tract infection. It dyes the urine orange, it can make a mess, it can stain things. So I'm just kind of curious if this might be a safer way of replacing Peridium in those as needed moments.
I don't know, because it doesn't have necessarily, it has the analgesic properties, but not necessarily anesthetic properties. But it's definitely, and it had it would take a longer course. Peridium's pretty instantaneous in that sense, whereas SSAV takes a little bit to like build up into the system. So, for instance, in our, I guess I didn't talk about this, in our double-blind placebo-controlled studies with the SSAV, we studied the patients through a course of 6 months. The longest it took a patient to respond, if they were going to respond, was 3 months. And so, and we found that some people can respond within that first week with positive. Some can take up to those full 3 months. And so we're studying a buildup effect, in this most recent study that we've never studied before beyond, case studies. And so this is the first time we're clinically studying it, looking at the buildup effect of starting at 6 a day, then going to 9 a day, then going to 12 a day the third month, and only if your symptoms have not abated at that point in that escalation dosage protocol, and then maintenance dosing back down, whereas typical people maintain on 1 to 3 capsules on average past those 3 months.
Okay, I was going to say, because taking 12 pills a day for the long haul
Yeah.
is a
No,
lot.
no, 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 no,
But I see your
no.
therapies are more to be used on a regular basis rather than on demand.
Yes, correct. It's specific to the SSAV. It's not going to be an on-demand. Maybe that's going to be our next thing to look at. Maybe now with pyridium and everything and the cancer warnings and all that other issues with the over-the-counter options. And and taking it like candy and for months or years at a time. Maybe we need to find a safer option.
So let's wrap up this podcast. I want to know how your aunt did.
Oh, she's doing very, very well. Yeah. So she's still on the allo today, and it maintains her interstitial cystitis symptoms. And that was even going through a journey with breast cancer, colon cancer, but still being able to maintain on the SSAV for her bladder.
Where can people find out more information about your company and your products?
Oh, definitely. They can check us out on the website, desertharvest.com. We're on social too, Desert Harvest Aloe Vera on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, I think, and all that stuff. So we're all there. Definitely check us out.
Last question. How did the company's name come about?
You know, when we were that first natural products conference, I mean, mind you, we're in Montana, so we're not necessarily in the desert, but the initial natural products conference my mom and my aunt went to was in Arizona, in the desert.
I love that. Well, Heather, thank you so much for telling us about your family's business and how it's evolved over the last 30 years and the really difficult challenges and patients that you're trying to treat with efficacious and safe options. And again, I want to applaud you for a lot of the research that you're doing in this space to really advance it. I think it's a really challenging space to it's hard to change practices of providers, right? And I think especially in the supplement space, and then going to doctors and saying, like, this could be more beneficial and potentially safer than some of the medications that you might be prescribing. There's certainly a role for supplements. And the more that we as healthcare providers can learn about them and the science behind them and understand what questions and how to tease it out for our patients in terms of third-party testing and what are the good products and what are the bad players, I think is really important. So thank you so much for joining us today on Pearls and Perspectives. And you have a great website. And I encourage people to check out your website for both their own practices and also direct their patients to learn more about your company and what they offer.
Thanks, Dr. Berman. This was wonderful. I enjoyed it.